Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Today we launched the February installment of our full bio series. That's when every month we take one of those big, fat, deeply researched biographies and discuss it with its author over the course of a week. This week marks the anniversary of the birth and death of Frederick Douglass. And all this week we'll be talking to historian David W. Blight about his 2018 Pulitzer Prize-winning biography, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. Blight used primary source material, Douglass's own words, plus new information drawn from private collections to produce an 829-page book that took a decade to write. Today we start with Frederick Douglass's early life. He was born in February 1818, but was never really certain of his birthday because he was born enslaved and barely knew his biological family. He spent his early years being loaned out to all kinds of households, some with fierce slave breakers. He was beaten and whipped. But there was one household in Baltimore where the mistress of the house allowed him to learn his letters. It was this act that changed his whole life. Young Fred became obsessed with words and learned how to use them to his advantage, including escaping and heading north from Baltimore in 1838 at the age of 20. We begin at the beginning. Here is part one of my conversation with David Blight. So, David, two of the most famous Black Americans were both enslaved people on the eastern shore of Maryland. Harriet Tubman, born Araminta Ross, and Frederick Douglass, who was born Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey. I think a lot of people can visualize, sadly, what slavery looked like in the Deep South. But what did slavery look like on the eastern shore of Maryland?
Slavery on the eastern shore of Maryland was a good deal different than on the other side of the Chesapeake Bay. There were very few cities or towns. There was more plantation-style agriculture. And Douglass, indeed, Frederick Bailey, grew up in part on the largest land holding in all of Maryland, the Y Plantation, which was a vast, self-sufficient plantation that grew everything it needed, and it backed up right onto the Chesapeake Bay. So, in effect, it backed up onto access to the ocean. But the eastern shore was always a little bit more out of the way, and some might say backward, than the eastern shore. In fact, in Douglass's own descriptions of it, he described the area he was born in as the worn-out soil of the eastern shore. Of course, that was when he was remembering his slavery days there.
Slavery destroyed families. How did it destroy Fred Bailey's biological family?
Well, Frederick Douglass was born probably in the cabin of his grandmother, Betsy Bailey. His mother, Harriet, was one of several daughters. And he never knew his kinfolk. He barely knew his mother. He last saw her when he was only 6 years old, and he had very few vivid memories of her. In fact, he invented images of her in his writing. He never knew who his father was, although he always heard that his father was one of his masters, and the best two candidates are his original owner, Aaron Anthony, and his second owner, Thomas Auld. But we still don't know for sure who Douglass's father was. He didn't even know his siblings, and he had four of them, until he was about 8 years old. He was sent from Baltimore. He had just been sent to Baltimore. I mean, he was sent back to Baltimore. I'm sorry, back to the Eastern Shore, because his owner, Aaron Anthony, had died, and all of Anthony's slaves were to be divided up. And there's a very vivid moment in Douglass's autobiographies where he describes all of Anthony's 25 or 30 slaves being lined up and divided up among kinfolk, or sold to so-and-so, or given to so-and-so. And he looked around and he said, many of these were my siblings. And he said, he didn't even know who they were. Now, he was sent back to Baltimore at that point, which was one of the several strokes of luck in his life. To Thomas Auld, and who was related to Aaron Anthony. But anyway, Douglas's kinfolk and family, if you will, was destroyed by slavery. In fact, he had little in the way of any sense of family until after he escaped from slavery at age 20 and made his own family. One of the great themes of Douglas's early life, and for that matter, throughout his life, was this search for home, this sense of a search to know what home was, where it was, and indeed who his kinfolk actually were. He will actually spend the rest of his days to the age of 77 trying to figure out who his father was, but he never really did conclusively know his paternity.
You write about a savage beating of his aunt. How did that change him?
He sees his Aunt Hester beaten by his owner, Aaron Anthony, who was possibly his father. Her naked back, she is strapped up to a wall. Anthony did not know that little Fred was in the room. Little Fred was 6 years old and hiding in a crawl space next to a fireplace in the kitchen house at the Y House plantation. He sees his aunt beaten bloody, because, according to Douglas's remembrance, she had rejected Anthony's sexual advances. She was only a late teenager at that time, and Anthony was known to abuse his women slaves, and in this case, brutally abused her. Douglas saw that. He saw the blood drip on the floor. He vividly describes it in the autobiography and makes a great deal of anti-slavery propaganda about that beating. It's not the first, and it's not the last beating he will see. And indeed, he will receive any number of beatings himself. Mm-hmm. But he turns that blood and that violence into a metaphor of at least one aspect of the very depths of what slavery could do to human beings, to both their bodies and their minds.
There are a few moments when Frederick Bailey catches a small break. It actually turns out to be a huge break, I should say, because he's sent to Baltimore. He's loaned out to Baltimore, and he encounters a woman who has never had a slave before, Sophie Auld. How did her initial treatment of him change him forever? And I think we should point out, she starts to teach him to read.
Oh, yes. Sophia Auld was his mistress, white mistress, in Baltimore, where he is sent when he's 7 years old. And in the first year and a half or so that he was there, he was supposed to be there to be the companion of the Auld son, whose name was Tommy. And that's fine. But he was obviously a bright kid, this Fred was, and Sophia all took him in. According to Douglas, later, she took him in like another son, and she began to teach him to read and write. She taught him his letters. She read out loud with him. She allowed him to collect other kinds of reading. She read the Bible with him, and that is how he learned his initial literacy until Sophia's husband, Hugh Auld, came in one day and saw her teaching little Frederick to read and allowing him to recite. And according to Douglas, his memory of it was that Auld vehemently instructed his wife, "You shall never teach that kid to read again. If you give an N-word an inch, they'll take an L," according to Douglas, and forbade his wife to teach literacy. Douglas has a wonderful reminiscence of that in the second autobiography, where he says, "That was the first anti-slavery speech I ever heard." He decided on the spot. He tells us that if all thought reading was so terrible, then maybe it's something he ought to get.
It was also, I mean, that was like anarchy for an enslaved person to read.
Well, it wasn't as uncommon as we might think.
It was illegal, though, right?
It was illegal in most states, that's true. And it was indeed illegal in Maryland. But there's no question that some slaves not only learned to read and write, but were actually taught so, sometimes by ministers, sometimes by their owners and their mistresses. But obviously, this is the most important skill Douglass ever achieved. It's one of the most important things about his life. It's also one of those mysteries that cannot be totally explained. Why did this 7, 8, 9-year-old kid take to language so much, so eagerly? What was it about this kid who just couldn't get enough to read? He encounters his white playmates in the streets of Baltimore. He's only 9 and 10 years old, and he finds that all of them are carrying around a school reader called the Columbian Orator. And Douglass tells us he wanted one of those. He wondered why he couldn't have one of those. He didn't get to go to school like the white kids. But he did manage, by the time he was 11, at a bookstore in Thames Street in Fells Point in Baltimore, to, in effect, barter for his own copy. And he got his own copy of the Columbian Orator by the age of 11 and 12. And that book became a treasure. That's actually what Douglass called it. A treasure in his life. This book was not only a compilation, first published in 1797, it was a compilation of speeches over the years, some of them from classical times like Demosthenes and Cicero, but most of them from the Age of Enlightenment, British and American, and it included some dialogues that had been invented by the book's creator, a man named Caleb Bingham. One of the dialogues in the book was this imaginary moment when a young slave just convinces his owner to free him. Now, this book became so crucial to Douglass, not just because of all these speeches he could eventually read, but most importantly, it was a manual of oratory. The introduction, the first 20 pages or more, is a manual. It's kind of a how-to book of how to give a speech, how to gesture with your hands, how to modulate your voice, what you do with your shoulders. And then from the middle on, it's an analysis of how great oratory must have moral messages and so on. There was no more important possession to Frederick Bailey, later Douglass, while he was a slave, than that book. And when he escaped from slavery at age 20, the only possessions he had on his body were the clothing where he was dressed in the disguise of a sailor, a hat, a wide-brimmed sailor's hat, a few dollars in one pocket, and his Columbian Order in the other pocket. In fact, one of my favorite memories of all the years of doing research on Douglass is one of the times I was at Cedar Hill, Douglass's house in Washington, D.C., which is a national park site now, and they have his original copy of the Columbian Orator. And they let me sit at his desk. I put on the white gloves. They let me hold that original edition in my own hands. It was like, touching and feeling Douglass's Holy Grail.
We'll continue the conversation with David Blight about his book, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. Coming up, we learn how Frederick Bailey escaped from Maryland and made his way to an area now known as Tribeca. And we'll hear how he and his wife, Anna, became the Douglasses after the break. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and we're back with more of my conversation with David Blight. We pick up Frederick Douglass's story with his plan to escape enslavement and start a new life in the North, where he ultimately settles in New Bedford, Massachusetts, and gets a new name and a newfound obsession, anti-slavery writing. He had tried to escape and was caught. He tries again and is successful in 1838 around the age of 20. What was different about his successful attempt as opposed to earlier attempt?
Well, the earlier attempt had been a scheme with about four or five other slave teenagers and young men, which was a very bad plan. They were going to steal some canoes and boats and just sail up the Chesapeake or row their way up the Chesapeake somehow. And they got caught. And at that point, Douglas was jailed for 2 weeks, where he didn't know if he'd be sold south or if he'd ever live to tell it. But when he escaped out of Baltimore in late August of 1838, it was a well-planned scheme. And it must be said here that if Douglas hadn't spent those years in Baltimore, we wouldn't know about him. Of his 20 years as a slave, he spent 11 of those years on the Eastern Shore. But he spent 9 of those years on and off in Baltimore, a city that was a major port to the ocean, a major maritime center, a city in which he encounters all kinds of other people, and a city in which he got very involved in the large free black community of Baltimore. There were far more free blacks in Baltimore than there were slaves. It's there that he meets Anna Murray, who would be his first wife. And it was in Baltimore where he had enough freedom of movement, not only to plan an escape, but to begin to imagine his way out of Baltimore. And the escape plan was simply, although it was incredibly dangerous, and it took enormous bravery to do it, he dressed as a sailor. He jumped on a train one morning, all perfectly planned for when the train would leave, with his little trunk. He had borrowed the identity papers of a black sailor who was retired. And he took three trains and three steamboats or ferry boats. He crossed three major rivers. And in about 38 hours from Baltimore, he arrived at the base of Chambers Street in Lower Manhattan in New York City. Had he been caught, we wouldn't even know about him. He'd have been sent back to Baltimore and probably finally sold south somewhere into cotton slavery. But that escape worked. It not only worked, within 2 days, he found his way to the house of David Ruggles, who operated a kind of vigilance group in New York City to protect fugitive slaves. It was from there he wrote a letter back to Baltimore. We don't know who that letter went to because Anna was not literate. But somebody got the word to Anna that he was safe in New York and that she was to come. This was all pre-planned. She had her bags packed. And she managed to buy a ticket, same three trains, same three ferry boats, and she arrived in New York City in the same 38 hours, and they got married in the parlor of David Ruggles, only a matter of 5 days after he had escaped out of Baltimore.
And New York friends, if you'd like to go see where that was, there's a lovely plaque at 36 Lispinard Street, right on the corner of Church Street there. What advice does David Ruggles give Fred Bailey? Now that he's arrived in New York,
yeah,
he's got to make a life.
Well, he tells him first, get the hell out of town. He says he and Anna should go north to New Bedford, Massachusetts. It would be safer. It was not safe in 1838 in New York City for most fugitive slaves. It was very risky business. But up in New Bedford, the major whaling port of New England, it was known as a kind of an enclave for fugitive slaves. It had a strong black community, and Ruggles even gave him a couple of names to look up as soon as they arrived. And Anna and Frederick, again on steamboats, and then by carriage, made their way to New Bedford, Massachusetts, where they spent their first night in the home of a free black man who was himself earlier an escaped slave. His name was Johnson. But at the first morning in that house, Douglas says I think I need a new name. And Mr. Johnson agreed with him. And Douglas thought, well, what should I pick? And he, Mr. Johnson told him, well, don't pick Johnson. There are way too many of us. Way too many of us. And Johnson, according to Douglas, had just been reading Sir Walter Scott's Lady of the Lake, which was an epic poem by the great Scott writer. And the hero in that epic poem is a man named Douglas with one S. Johnson tells him this. Douglas said, I like that name. I like the sound of it. But I'm going to give it one more S for distinction. And that's how Douglas became Frederick Douglass. It was on the first morning in New Bedford, Massachusetts. He and Anna will live in New Bedford for the next 3 years. Their first three children will be born there. I'm sorry, first two children will be born there. Douglas worked in every kind of manual labor you can imagine in that great whaling port. He carried whale oil casks. He worked in a foundry. He did all kinds of odd jobs for people. But here's one of my favorite facts about Douglas. Either in his first year or his second year, certainly by 1840, because there's a record, he walked to City Hall, which was only two blocks from where they were living, and he registered to vote. And I found the record. It's right there. It says Frederick Douglass. It gives his address. He paid the $1.50 poll tax. Massachusetts had a poll tax. And by the way, it wasn't a poll tax to try to prevent anybody from voting necessarily. It was a poll tax to try to pay for the electoral system. But what we do know is that by the time he was 21 or 22, the runaway slave, illegal immigrant, if you like, Frederick Douglass registered to vote.
Frederick Douglass is in New Bedford, working as a laborer. He takes a liking to another piece of writing, The Liberator, a paper.
Oh, yeah.
How does this paper ignite his career as an abolitionist?
It's almost as important as the Columbian Orator. When Douglas discovers this newspaper, edited by William Lloyd Garrison in Boston, this radical anti-slavery paper, he was stunned. He read it voraciously every month. Every week. It was a weekly paper. And he would even tack it on the wall in one of his jobs. He worked the bellows in a foundry down by the docks. And he said he could work that bellows with one arm, and he could kind of follow the newspaper. He'd tack it up on the wall, and he would read The Liberator while working that bellows. I mean, all of us may have had jobs early in our life where we weren't doing anything intellectually challenged, and we looked for something to distract us. But the paper was full of analyses of slavery. It was full of stories about slavery. And at that point, Douglas didn't care what the ideological bent of the paper was. He was just thrilled to find a newspaper that was engaged in this radical criticism of the existence of slavery and even the existence of racism. And it will soon lead to him being discovered by some of the disciples of William Lloyd Garrison, because Douglas didn't only read this Liberator. He got involved in the local black church. In fact, it's one of the first things he did. There was a small African Methodist Episcopal Zion church in New Bedford. They called it the Little Zion. And he may have gotten involved there literally the first month or two they were there. But within the first year, they had him preaching. They found out this kid could preach. And he'd been doing that already back on the Eastern Shore. He was running a kind of a debate group and a preaching group among his slave buddies when he was 18 on the Eastern Shore. But he started to preach. And the congregation decided to ordain him. In the AME Zion Church at that point, you could be ordained as a preacher just by the congregation getting together with its elders and declaring you a preacher. You didn't have to go to divinity school. He was actually technically ordained by them. And that's where he learned to a certain extent, the principles of homiletics, of how you preach to the text of the Bible. Each week had its text. And it was while giving one of these sermons. He didn't preach there every week. He was one of the preachers. He's 21, probably, or 22 at the most, when he was first discovered there by some white abolitionists who dropped in to go to church that day or to see what was happening. And one thing led to another, and it was after that that he got invited first to a convention of abolitionists that met in New Bedford, and then especially by William Lloyd Garrison's organization, the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society. He was invited in the late summer, 1841, when he's 23, to take the steamer out to Nantucket, to an anti-slavery convention on Nantucket Island. And it was in August 1841 at Nantucket in the Athenaeum Library, which is still there, where Douglass gave his first real speech to white abolitionists. And he was a hit, a big hit. In fact, it was a two-day convention. He spoke on the first day, and they invited him to speak again the second day. And what Douglass did in this first speech, we don't have an actual text of it, but we know the kinds of speeches he was then quickly giving, was basically telling stories from his slave life.
Mm-hmm.
The stories we end up later reading about in his narrative, stories about the Eastern Shore, stories about the White Plantation, stories about the Alds in Baltimore, and so on and so on. There he was at age 23. Now, he does tell us that he, you know, quaked in his boots that first time he had to get up on that big platform at the Athenaeum and speak to this august room full of white abolitionists. But he triumphed. He says he trembled when he first started speaking, but he not only got through it, he wowed them. And Garrison then hired him to be an itinerant lecturer on the anti-slavery circuit. And by September and October of that fall, 1841, he was a slightly paid itinerant lecturer for the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society. And it is the last time in Douglass's life that he would do manual labor for pay. He'd do manual labor again for his own home and his own, you know, homestead here and there. But the rest of Douglass's life from that day forward, he made a living with his voice and his pen. And he's one of the few people in the 19th century who could actually do that.
That was David Blight talking about his biography, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, for our monthly series, Full Bio. Tomorrow, we continue our conversation with how Douglass became such an effective anti-slavery speaker and how his ability to connect with his audiences made him one of the most prominent abolitionists in the United States.